Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Fell Into Food podcast. I am your host, Chef Jeff Fell, and I'm in the middle of a cornfield here with Dave and Joseph Fisher of Fisher Farms. This is going to be an amazing episode as we are, as I said, live here on the farm, and we're going to talk all about the practices that they do and just fun stuff being on the farm. So, gents, thanks for being on. Appreciate your time. And trekking out into a corn, into the field. So Dave, let's maybe just describe.
Should I start a little bit with what we got here?
Yeah. Then? What, where are we and why are we in this field?
So I guess we fell into a field, right?
Yeah.
All right. So this looks like a cow pea right here. We've got a, this is a summer mix that we plant for the cattle. We do an annual ryegrass basically from September till June. And then when it gets too hot for the ryegrass, we plant a lot of summer plants. So we got some cow peas, we got buckwheat, we got sorghum sedan grass, we got some brassicas down here. These nice leaves kind of look like, you know, kale or cabbage, whatever you want to call it. What else did I say? Oh, yeah. Sunflower. Got a sunflower there with the seed about ready to pop out there, head ready to pop out. We got some sun hemp. So why we plant all the variety is because the variety really builds the soil better than just a single plant. Also, with all these plants, the legumes produce the nitrogen for the sorghum sedan grass, so we don't have to fertilize it. So it's just a real healthy environment. It's kind of basically, you know, in nature, there weren't monocultures, you know, thousands of years ago, right? It was all a mixture and they all grew well together. And, you know, it's amazing. I've been reading a lot lately. Dr. Christine Jones in Australia talks a lot about how the roots intertwine. And when those roots intertwine is when you get the most benefit and the synergies between the plants. So we've been doing this quite a few years to where we just have this mixture in the cows who are heading over our way here. Hopefully they'll spot us before they start eating around us. But anyways, the cows really like it. They get a lot of beneficial minerals from having the, you know, the multiple different crops. You know, what you get out of sun hemp and what you get out of the cow peas is different than the sorghum sedan grass, which has a lot of sugars in it and so forth. So the better the mixture, the, you know, the better the feed.
Yeah, so maybe let's take a step back because, again, right, we know where we're at. Who is Fisher Farms? You know, obviously we mentioned cows, so, you know, but it's more than just cattle. So who, just the quick, you know, 30,000 foot, who is Fisher Farms?
Yeah, so we are a sixth-generation family farm here in southern Indiana, so we're right outside of Jasper, Indiana. So we raise beef cattle on our farm. We sell that, you know, directly out into the market. So we sell it under the Fisher Farms label. We like to say we sell everything under the values of being premium, natural, local, and sustainable. So top quality meat that you can feel good about eating.
Right. And again, we've got generations number
five and six,
like live here. So they're involved in the day-to-day operations. And I'm excited to say that I'm now working with them as well. So it's going to be a fun adventure. And, you know, those that watch on a regular basis, you know, the meat that I use that I'm in the studio with, you know, it's their product. Like the product is literally from these cows, these guys literally that are over to our left, which we'll get some shots of because I want you guys to see all of it. But, you know, a big thing, like it's natural, it's premium, it's quality, you know. So maybe, you know, you touched on basically just like some of the earth stuff, but, you know, what makes it, you know, a really natural process on the farm, and what the, and then we can maybe lead into some of the ultimate, the goals that you have already achieved and where it's going.
Yeah, sure. I can hit on some of like the quality pieces from like a market standpoint, and then I'll let my dad, Dave, talk more about kind of what the natural side of things and the sustainability components. So from a quality standpoint, we always felt like what was really important when we're, you know, selling to chefs, you know, like yourself, is at first you want to start with serving a really great meal. And so we really focus on quality first, and, you know, make sure those sustainability and those natural practices fall in line. So we start with good genetics, but then we're also raising them in a way where it's not just good every once in a while, it's good each and every time. And so we do that with what they're eating. So stuff like this, but then also, you know, making sure we're keeping them well fed their whole life. And then, you know, from a processing standpoint, it's, you know, cut fresh after it's dry aged for 14 days, you know, delivered, you know, very shortly thereafter to the customer. So we really want that top quality product that, you know, chefs are excited to serve. And then those other things kind of falling behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would just add to that, that, you know, quality always starts off with genetics. And we've been really particular about the genetics, and we've been selling to restaurants now for 20 years. And when we first started doing it, I was the guy picking the bull, putting it up with the cow, you know, 9 months later having a calf, seeing that all through, 20 minutes later actually butchering it, and then picking out which ones to be butchered, and then actually sorting the steaks, looking at the steaks every time, delivering those to the chefs, and getting their immediate feedback. And that really helped me understand what really is quality, and you know, what are they looking for. And it's really, you know, that combination of tenderness and really a savory beef flavor, as well as the marbling. You know, you've got to have all three of those to have really good quality. And as I always say, it's easy to do that one time. The hard thing is to do that every time.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, restaurants need to have. And that's also one thing where I think we're different than, you know, the conventional beef there. You know, most of the conventional beef plants are 6,000, 8,000 head a day. And they're bringing those cattle in, they're running them through. Somebody's looking at the ribeye for 3 seconds and deciding what quality grade that is. They have no information on the genetics, the life of that animal, as well as really the tenderness. I mean, they're not going to do shear tests and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. So it's just a real quick, and I think most chefs see that now. You know, you may get a case of ribeyes where one's really good and one's not so good. And that's because they just don't have the control of the supply chain like, you know, like we're able to do being a small farm.
Right. And what breed of cattle? They're running around over here. It's hard not to look at them. What breed of cattle? When you talk about those genetics, maybe talk a little bit about, like, what you started with and what you're looking for when it comes to genetics.
Yep. So our base genetics is Angus, but within Angus, it's really broad. As somebody told me just today, within the Angus breed, there's as much variability as all the other breeds put together.
Wow.
And there's so when you say Angus, now you got to get down to what they call the EPDs, the expected progeny definition, which is basically numbers that the Angus Association has in their huge database to tell you which cattle, which lines of genetics are going to have the best marbling, which one's going to have the best tenderness, which animals are going to be docile. And with a docile animal, you just get less toughness in the meat and so forth. So those are some of the things that we're looking for in the Angus side. And then we do crossbreed. It's well known in the cattle business that when you cross, you generally get a better outcome in every aspect of the animal. They'll stay longer in your herd. They're better mamas. They also marble better. And so, but you have to pick the right cross, and the only cross that we've really found to work well is Shorthorn.
Okay.
And, but again, Shorthorn is really variable. So we use one Shorthorn breeder. He's actually up by Chicago, and he does DNA analysis on every single one of his bulls that will tell him basically which ones are the best marblers. And then from that, we'll pick the top 20% of his. So we're generally looking for about the top 10% in the Angus breed. And the top 20% of the Shorthorn, we put them together and we get a really good, consistent marbling, consistent size beef.
Right. So now we've talked about the cattle, and then we briefly touched why we're in this field. But let's talk about, like, what their diet is. You know, we talk natural because a lot of people just think it's instantly, you know, if it doesn't say grass fed, that it means it's not. It's great, grade A quality,
right.
But it's not the case. Right?
Right.
But so let's talk maybe like what their feeding habits are like and why, you know, it lends so well to the product.
Yeah. So there was a study done by Michigan State, and I probably read it 15, 20 years ago. But what it main point was, cattle have to have a good day every day their entire life. If you have time periods where the cattle's not being fed well, where they're just out on like fescue grass and they're only gaining a pound a day, which sounds a lot to a human, but if you got a 600-pound calf, that's not really not that much. And they're growing, you know, they're like teenagers. You know, if you get a teenager who's being starved basically of energy, well, those fat deposits in their meat go away. They suck that out of the meat. And then what a lot of the big feedlots want to do is then pour corn to them at the end. Well, all those fat cells are already gone in the meat, so now all you get is the fat around the outside. And everybody's seen those ribeyes with a huge fat on the outside and that big chunk of fat down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
That's all due to the feeding, a little bit of the genetics, but mostly due to the feeding, where if you give them that more of a slower growth, which is plants like these. We also do a lot of silage. Those kind of feed really gives them a good consistent growth. They don't lose those fat cells. They just send in at the end. We do give them a little bit of grain to really blossom those fat cells to where you can now see those little lines of fat in them.
Yeah, so they basically get to roam, graze these beautiful fields, and then go up and grab silage as they feel necessary. Yeah.
And especially in the winter months, you know, pasture looks great today, but come January,
right,
you know, it's going to be a little bit tougher. We do plant ryegrass, and we're out there grazing it just about all winter long, but we also supplement them with silage. And so to me, that silage also kind of finishes them off to where they've got enough fat in the meat to where you get that really good beefy flavor in it.
Yeah, but I think it's important to know that you also control the silage.
Yes. Right?
It's not a bought product, which again, people might think, okay, well, that's great, you know, but you're buying something. No, you guys have complete vertical integration of the supply chain,
right,
which allows you to have a lot of benefits that most anyone else doesn't get. You control the feed, you control the raising, you control everything, even up to the slaughter. And I want to talk the slaughter too. So maybe talk about that process of how you create your silage and like what they're eating, you know, in the off seasons.
I've talked sure. enough for a while.
Sure. So yeah, silage is, you know, we have silage choppers that can come through, and, you know, ryegrass in the spring months is what we're chopping. And we're basically taking, you can think of it as like cutting grass clippings. You're storing that in a big bunker where you suck out all the air, you know, you put plastic over the top to make it airtight. And that ferments, and that really retains that nutritional value for those cows for whenever we're ready to feed it to them. And then, so we do that in the spring, and some of that in the fall as well. But then we also do the corn silage that we chop. So we're chopping that entire stalk. You know, we're not just taking that ear, that, you know, just the kernels, taking that entire stalk, chopping it like you would, you know, grass clippings, storing it in that bunker as well. So you still get that energy rich, but it keeps that nutrients all year round. So it's not super high energy, but it's enough energy that those cows can keep those fat cells in the meat like you're talking about.
Right.
But then, you know, we have bunkers actually not too far from here where we store that. And then that's where, you know, our team feeds the cows from that mixture every day. And depending on their age, you know, we're going to give them a little bit different ratio. But that's what they eat all year round.
I would probably add to that, it's also important to talk about the things we don't feed our cattle and we don't give our cattle. So growth hormones is probably the biggest thing a lot of people have heard about. You know, the growth implants that they put in the ear make the cattle grow 10 to 15% faster. You know, to me, it's got to be a health issue. I've had a lot of people say, oh, it's just a small amount. I said, well, if it's such a small amount, why does that muscle grow 10 to 15% faster? And, you know, feeding that, you know, do you really want to feed that to your kids and so forth? You know, to me, it just doesn't make sense that we in the U.S. do that. So that's part of the issue. The other thing is like ionophores, which when you feed a lot of grain, they have to feed an ionophore to keep the pH level up in the rumen so it doesn't get too acidic. So, you know, that plus, you know, at the end of their day, they're at 80, 90% grain when they're trying to finish them out. So these cattle are really just taking in all that energy at one time. Rumen has a hard time adjusting to that, so they have to feed more chemicals to get them to be able to, you know, utilize that grain. Ractopamine is one of them and so forth to make those muscles grow larger. You know, it's just amazing to me that most countries in the world have banned those drugs, and yet here in the U.S. it's common practice.
Wow.
Jesus. So to me, that also is why our beef has that kind of old-time butcher shop flavor, because we're not adding all these things.
Yeah. So then we, you know, we've gotten them raised, they're good, but I think it's then also like the finishing process, right? Mm-hmm. So how they're getting to the slaughterhouse, like how relaxed they are. Cause that was a big point for me when, you know, I was a customer at one point of like, wow, you do these small batches and people don't, all they think is commercial, right, you know, beef, and they just see thousands getting slaughtered at a time. Maybe talk about that, you know, that those their final days, but you know how important it is for some of that tenderness of the meat.
Right. So our processing facility is 3 miles from our farm here, which is nice and super convenient. And that, you know, our butchers, when they're literally ready for more, they can text us and say, hey, can you drop off 15? Can you drop off 10? You know, however many they've got room for, we're dropping them off. They're not hanging out there very long. They're not waiting on trailers. They're getting, you know, process one at a time. So it's a very stress-free process because ultimately we want that from a humane standpoint, but then also from a, you know, quality of the beef standpoint too. Stressed out animals are, you know, tough right. meat. But then also, you know, we don't want them hanging out on trailer for a while where they're going to get dehydrated or maybe lose their blood sugar will drop, which creates dark cutters. And so really just want that to be as smooth of a process as possible. And what we like to say is, you know, they have a great life and then all of a sudden it's, you know, lights out. Yeah. And we really want to be that stress free as possible.
Yeah. And then the processing plant, I mean, you've got, you know, another family that you guys have grown with as well. So you know how the cows are being slaughtered, you know how the meat's being cut. And a big benefit is the flexibility and the customization with the cutting. So maybe talk about how flexible you really can be, right? A lot of chefs just, okay, this is the cuts it comes in and, you know, this is special order, that's special order. But what you do is a lot, you can get anything you want almost out of these cattle.
Yeah, exactly. We like to say we can cut that cow or that pig, you know, however you want, right? Like, we've got the whole animal to work with. So we can be super flexible on that front. But yeah, to your point about working with Sander Processing, the Sander family, we've been working with them since we started and they've been really, really great to work with and grown with us as we've grown and giving us that flexibility, but then also that traceability too, is to, you know, to your point about that ear tag number stays with that carcass all the way until we cut those ribeye steaks. And so when we, you know, in-house grade our ribeyes and we say, you know, this is the quality that we expect, we can go back up the chain and say, all right, that was the cow's mom, that was the cow's dad, they're still producing really top quality, you know, meat. And then if for, you know, hopefully it doesn't happen very often, and it generally doesn't happen very often, but if something were to, you know, not grade out the way we want and we, you know, don't want to sell it as, you know, steaks, we can go and, you know, go upstream and figure out what happened. And that's in part because Sander Processing allows us to keep that traceability all the way till the cut steak. But yeah, as far as the customization goes, there's always a new cut. There's always a new thing. It used to be the Food Network, but now it's, I get TikTok videos sent to me from chefs. And yeah. I had a video sent to me in Italian one time. And, you know, and it's, we really just want to give that flexibility ultimately to the end chef customer and let us know how you want us to cut it.
Yeah.
You know, from our side, we don't care. You know, we're happy to accommodate those things. And from our side, we have an in-house system that allows us to add products in a matter of literally seconds. And so we're up to over 2,100 internal SKUs, and that just allows us to have over 45 different ways to cut a short rib.
Well, that, and then at the facility, you know, I was in back there packing pork chops, you know, myself. But another unique thing that most don't get is the vacuum sealing of a lot of the products. So the shelf life is incredibly long, you know, 28, 30 days, because you're vacuum sealing, you know, such a fresh product individually. It's not whole case. It's literally, I mean, I packed, I don't even know how many, what are 18 cases of pork chops, each one individually packed. So, you know, that each one of those is going to last another 20 days. So even through the supply chain, a lot of people don't understand that from the time of farm to slaughter to when you get it at your restaurant, that product may be a couple weeks old already. And you don't even realize that. And then what's the shelf life once you've thought, and again, is it a fresh product or is it frozen? Because a lot of times in commercial, it's coming in frozen because of the mass quantities. Whereas now you have these individual pieces that, you know, a chef has that flexibility of if maybe it is a more specialty thing and they're like, yeah, we can only get through 10 a month, but they're going to get through all 10 and they're not going to waste. So then that way the cow, you know, at the end of the day, its life wasn't wasted for, you know, just for product to get thrown into the trash. So that was really, I really liked how, you know, everything is packed and still kind of that old school feel. You know, I looked at every pork chop, right? It was look at every single one, make sure there's no break in the seal. I found one. Denise was pretty proud of me. She's like, wow, that's a good one. And I was like, yes. All right. I did my job well. I caught it. She went and repacked it, you know, literally walked over, repacked it and got it into the package. So, you know, that each one, like literally everything is looked at. Yes. I was doing ground sausage, ground turkey. And the level of detail, and this is what I love as a chef, is the level of detail. It was like, we're snipping off the ends because there's just tiny little bits of plastic that have just tiny bits of meat. Most people just leave that. But it's like, no, we snip that off so it has a better appearance. That's service that you don't even see. You don't even realize what's going on behind the scenes to make sure that that tube of sausage, while in the grand scheme of things may not seem like a lot, it's devil's in the details. And for chefs, that's everything. So maybe, what was the decision to like cryo vacuum seal everything to provide that shelf life.
To me, it was, you know, a big decision, I don't know, close to 20 years ago now. You know, when we first started, of course, we went frozen. You know, we were butchering 2 beef a month, you know, and so forth. And, you know, I've got a lot of stories that kind of pushed us over the edge of getting us to where we were butchering every week. And that really started about 2006 when we were able to butcher. I think we started off with 2 beef every week. And we started that in 2006. Next thing I shot up in Bloomington was the customer that kind of pushed us over the edge. They started buying 200 pounds of burger from us every week, some inside rounds. We had some other customers. Once we went fresh, you know, you can just see all the chefs and the retail stores just so much appreciate that. I remember the one Blooming Foods, when they went from frozen to fresh, and it was a little bit of decision on their side, you know, how they were going to market it, how they were going to present it, how they were going to make sure they didn't have any product go bad, you know, all that kind of stuff. But their sales tripled when they went to fresh.
Wow. You know,
everybody just wants the fresh product, and it makes so much sense. I had a chef explain it to me one time. When you freeze that meat, those cells burst.
Yep.
When they burst, you're going to lose all that juice. And everybody's seen it, right? When you take something out of the freezer, put it on a plate for a couple of days in the fridge, thawed out. Well, now your plate's got all this juice in it. Well, that was in the meat. So now you got drier meat.
Yep.
So, yeah, to me, it's fresh. And the other thing that I think we really do difference is everything is made to order. We don't have a big inventory.
Nope.
And we don't store a whole bunch of finished good product, and we're waiting to ship it out to, you know, whoever calls next. When we get an order, we then butcher to that order. But luckily with Sanders working with us, you know, that's 2 days, 3 days, we'll get it to the customer. But it's wonderful, being a kind of a supply chain nerd that I am, to have that fresh and made to order. Just makes things so much easier, so much smoother to the customer.
Yeah, and then the one that's not here, you know, Diana, running everything behind the scenes, like it's like a mad scientist on that side from a logistics standpoint, to keep all that straight, all the paperwork, and showed me the system. And I was like, I mean, it makes total sense. Colors for the days of delivery and color clipboards for the type of products. You just know, you know, the team knows this is what's got to get picked and pulled and shipped out. And so just incredible on the logistics side of how you've grown and taken it, but kept it like, again, that family feel. Like you walked in and it didn't feel like this big just processing plant. It was like, no, there's real people here packing, working, you know, as a team and as a family to get the same goal of fresh quality product. Hey everybody, we had to come into the actual processing facility and talk with Diana Fisher. We're out in the fields, but you know, I think it would be good to actually see what gets done in here. So Diana, thanks for joining me reluctantly to record, but I think it'd be just fun to maybe go kind of what your background, like what you do here at the farm. And you know, it's kind of the central nervous system, as I kind of call it. You know, everything's got to get out and shipped, and people don't really understand that side of things. But and then I may even pop off camera, because it's just going to be cool to see talking about it, and maybe we even look at stations and kind of some of the stuff that we do. So just take it away.
Okay. So this is where we get all the meat in the box and get it out the door. And we have several stations, and each station has kind of their specialty. Right now we are at the steak station. And what we do then, after the meat is cut from the processing side, it's brought over to us on carts and trays, and then we sort it. We have pick pack sheets that tell us what item goes to which customer. And here's a good example of our New York strips. We have the 12-ounce New York strips. We have several different places that take them. So they come on trays. We lay them all out. And we, you know, some customers like them less marbled. Some like them more. And we have all those notes on our sheets. And we sort them. And then we put them in the box, labeled by their delivery code. And we also label it. It's color-coded by the day of the week it goes out and by the product code. So like I said, here's steaks. Keith is doing, looks like he's working on turkey over here and roasts on that station. And then Eddie does ground beef. Denise does pork. Carla's over there with the different tubes, and then she also does our direct ship customers, getting everything in a box and getting it boxed up, iced, and shipped so that it arrives on your doorstep.
Yeah, so I think it's really cool. We talked in the field about how each product is like packed individually and why that's so unique. And then maybe just talk about how, you know, we've got human hands looking at products before it goes in the box. You know, you put me to work yesterday, you know, looking at every pork chop, making sure no seals are broken. But like you said, that customization, if a customer wants a particular marbling, or you have a lot of control over that, also on the sizing, right? You know,
yes.
This is human hands doing human work, and not everything's going to be perfect. So you're not going to have a steak that's exactly the same size. So maybe just talk a little bit about that.
So when we get the trays, we usually just lay them out. Like this one's closer to a 10 ounce. This one's pretty close to right on the 12 ounce. And then this is getting up to closer to a 13 ounce. And so we know which customers by our notes, which ones can take which. You know, most of the retail stores are fine if it's a variable, but you know, if it's on a menu at a restaurant, they want it to be the 12 ounce. And so we go through that. But yeah, we pull them all out of the trays, lay them out, sort them as we go. And then we go to our sheet and divide out which ones go where. And then if we have like the odd size, like a 14 ounce, we have customers that want those. So we put those on a different tray. And then on our sheets, it tells us who gets the 14 ounce ones, and we can pull those out and send those to them. I enter the orders every day, and then our computer system takes them and divides it out for what we call our pick pack sheets. And these are the steak sheets, color coded by black clipboards, and then yellow is what ships out on Tuesday. And then we can go on, let's see, we have a really good example of that on this one. These are what go out on Thursday. We have 16 ounce, 8 ounce, 12 ounce holes. All of our strips are on here, and then that's how we decide where they go, and then it lists our customer. Everybody has a laptop by their station where they can print the label that goes specifically for that delivery truck and their code.
So everyone's got their stations, and maybe we can walk around here a minute and pop behind camera. But again, it's that human element of physically touching, seeing, hey, something's off, figuring out what went wrong. And then the great part is, and I'll show a kind of just a picture into the rollaway door. Literally the cutting facility is attached right through, you know, a rollaway door that they can run over and check on something, talk to the butchers, hey, something's not right, a customer needs this. So it's not this delayed process of, all right, well, we got to get a hold of the meat processing or the meat, you know, cutting plant, and let me ask them this and this. It's instant. There's no delay.
And everybody has their sheets that they work on every week. So the nice part about that is you could catch the errors. So if I miskey a code and it shows up fresh side sliced, Denise will come in and say, hey, this customer always takes whole sides. They never take it sliced. So, you know, is it a new product? Did they change their menu? So it helps catch the errors, because if you're doing it every week, you know what that customer always takes. And it's also like, if I enter it on the wrong day, you know, they'll catch that for me too and say, hey, they usually ship out on Tuesdays, but, you know, they're not on Tuesday sheet. And, you know, I'm like, oh, this week they moved to Friday, you know, because they're closed. Or, you know, just it's just a double check for each other that we can do that.
And it's you get to know the customers. You start to know what they need, what they want. And that provides a consistent product for them as well, for their restaurants or their food establishment. And they're not worried about, you know, one day getting, you know, a half ounce or, you know, and some of these guys, these are big boys, you know, 3/4 pound, you know, steaks. And then the next week they're getting half pound steaks.
Right.
And then their customer isn't expecting that.
Right.
And then they have it. Now they're trying to explain, and they're coming back and saying, why am I getting this versus this? Because it's not this machine just kind of sorting it based upon what hopefully they think a label says, or, you know, machines do break. They don't, they're not perfect.
Well, and then we also have, like, somebody will text me and say, hey, I forgot to order ham. Can you send my ham? And then I can always just say, hey, Denise, which ham do they usually take? And then she's like, oh, they always take their shaped, you know? So it's just that, you know the customer and you know what you pack for them.
Yeah, so I'm pop behind camera. Let's maybe just do a quick walkthrough. And again, I don't want to get into anyone's way, but like you pointed out the stations, but maybe we can get some video of seeing some of the products, and then, you know, I don't know if there's any sausage left from yesterday, because just the level of detail we talked about, the level of detail of attention to some things that you wouldn't be like, oh, why? That just seems like a pain. Why would we do that? So maybe let's try and walk around and see some of that. Maybe we can even go into the dry room and talk about some of those excess products that are under the Fisher Farms product. We talked about that, but actually showing people, like, it's actually here. These are the products. So let's do a walk around.
This is a good example. Eddie's putting, these are our smash balls, and these are the 6 ounce ones, right?
6 ounce.
Yes. So we do 3 ounce, 4 ounce, 5 ounce, 6 ounce, and 8 ounce, right? And I don't know if you can see, but there's 6 balls in here, and then Eddie boxes those up. I think we had some 3 ounce ones yesterday. And we also do different blends. Like this is for a specific customer. And so they want like short rib brisket and I think chuck roast in this blend. So we make that for them. It comes over on a tag from Sanders what is specifically in that tray so we don't get them mixed up. And then Eddie double checks them, make sure that they're right. Then I think this is what you were talking about yesterday with the tubes.
Yes.
So we trim those ends because when it comes out of the machine, they clip them and then we have this little excess on there and it just, I don't know, we just don't like the way it looks. So we clip those off. And so we don't send the product out. It's just like a little end off there.
Yeah, but it shows attention to detail. Right, it's those little things of getting those ends snipped and not having plastic in food,
sitting
around in your refrigerator that could, you know, I know when you get sausage at the store and you see those little nasty pieces, you don't want that to get into the product. So it's just those little attention to detail that, to me, make it even more personalized, that it's not just mass manufacture.
I always think of it, if I would go to the store and I wouldn't buy it because of the way it looked, I don't want to ship it out that way. So if it's, you know, just kind of a messy label or it's torn, when I look at it at the store, I'm like, oh, something wrong with that, so I won't buy it. So we try to catch those things. We have another interesting thing we do is some people like the small length on their sausage links. Like this is a 1/4 pound, so there's 4 to 1. And then some people like the longer ones, like if you're going to do more of like a hoagie, peppers and onions type thing. So we can order or, you know, have them make 3 to 1s or 4 to 1s, which is nice for like restaurants too. They can offer the smaller ones for like the kids menu and bigger ones for, you know, like I said, the big full sandwich. Over here is where we have, this is like where we box up for all the individuals. We put them in alphabetical order and everybody has their sheets and then they can come over and drop into their box. And this is Carla's getting ready for ship out. So we line the boxes with this. It's a recycled plastic liner, and it also dissolves, and it's made here in Indiana. We have environmentally friendly ice packs, and so Carla boxes, she'll pull that order over, get it all ready in here, and then we take it to FedEx for any delivery out of Indiana, and we use Now Courier for any deliveries in Indiana.
I want to show that roll door real quick of processing. So right through there literally is where the product is being cut, cleaned, specced, and it comes through this doorway and literally right here to where it can be packed and shipped out to the customers.
Here's another example. These are short ribs, and I think we have 200 SKUs for short ribs because we can cut them so many different ways. But these are like the individual portioned. I think these are 6 ounce. It's so nice because, you know, Sanders, we can just go over and say, hey, this customer wants a whole plate. This customer wants some portion. And or somebody will call and say, I want to get it cut this certain way, I can run over real easily to Kent and ask him if that's a possibility. And they've been great to work with when we have, like, I wouldn't say, I call them custom cuts. Because, you know, it's more than just boneless. They want it, you know, without the flap or with the flap or something like that. You can go look at our maple syrup. So we work closely with an Amish farmer in Orleans. And we also like to offer Indiana products. So we offer Tell City pretzels on our website. They're made here in Jasper. And then our maple syrup comes from Jerry. It's probably about 45 minutes away. They tap all their trees and then they send us, and it's so good. And it's just neat that we work with that whole community. We get maple syrup from them. We get sorghum from them, which in that comes out kind of in the fall. That crop will be done. And then he also does a hickory syrup. So we offer that for him too. All right, and then eggs. He has a big flock and all of his children have flocks, and we get eggs from them every week.
So how does that process work, right? Being the Amish, they have special processes to do things. Just briefly, you know, how do you get the eggs? How do those transactions work? Because, again, they don't use technology.
Yes. So we email or text his neighbor, who is not Amish. We've been working with her for years. She'll either print out my email or write it out. She will then take it over to Jerry. And then Jerry writes me notes. When our truck goes to pick up, Jerry also tells our truck driver, who will then also text me. But Jerry will not call or talk to me by phone, or he doesn't have one. And he will not even let me be on speakerphone. Like if we're trying to figure out, you know, he was doing produce there for us for a while when his kids were younger. And he would have certain types of squashes and stuff that I didn't really know what they were. And I wanted to get more information. And so Rachel went over. I had to talk to Rachel on the phone. She would talk to Jerry. Jerry would then answer Rachel. She would tell me. But she could not put me on speakerphone so that we could talk back and forth. That was against their beliefs, and which we really respect that. And despite, you know, no modern communication, it's either regular letters through the mail or, you know, just kind of telephone through Rachel. We get the orders every week. We send him all the boxes. He'll write me a letter saying, I'm short on boxes. Can you send me some? Our truck driver will deliver them. Sometimes my parents run them up because he forgets to tell me. But it's been a great relationship. We've been working with him for a really long time. I'd say probably 15 years, if not longer.
Awesome. Anything else we're missing in the packing process?
No, I don't think so. We just, the orders come in, text, email, or phone. I enter them into our homegrown computer system. Dave and Joseph developed it several years ago. And through just entering in that one place, it does our pick pack sheets, our process plan, which is what we take over to Sanders. They don't really care where it goes. They just need to know how many to cut. So I take it over to them. Carts come back to us. We get them all in the box and we make the delivery notices for our truck drivers of where it all goes. And the computer system also does all the invoicing. And we also keep track of inventory through that.
Wow. It's been really insightful getting all the information. I can't wait for people to watch this episode, to be honest, because just seeing what you guys do. And again, that family, we talked about family and how it's such an integral part of everything, that from the farm to the facility to the customer, you feel it. It's just part of it. Again, I was in there yesterday working with them, and there was just, hey, try this. It's probably a little faster than doing this, right? Yeah. They've been doing it. versus let's just see if this guy can figure it out. It was, let's make his life a little easier, you know, even just for a few hours in the warehouse. So it's been great. And I just want to say thank you for taking time. I know you are incredibly busy getting orders in, out, and everything else. So thank you, Diana.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you here. So glad to have you here. Thanks.
All right.
On that family, you know, togetherness kind of atmosphere at work. You know, none of us want to have a snippy or negative atmosphere at work and so forth. So we're really big on making sure everybody gets along. There's no negative, you know, vibes and so forth in it. And that's huge for everybody, employees as well as I think it shows up. It ends up in our product because everybody cares about what's happening.
Yeah. So on the logo, right, we see a cow and a pig.
Yep.
So a lot of people are like, and even I was like, you know, pigs on the farm. So like, where does the pigs come from? And maybe talk a little bit about that, you know, reassure people. They're like, because again, it goes beyond pigs, but just that's the starting point, you know, why the pig on the logo and how does that all happen?
Yeah. So we started and, you know, when we started, we were just beef. So you may see at some point our original logo was just, you know, the Fisher Farms with just a cow head. But then as we started working with chefs, they're like, you know, other farmers can, or a lot of times they'd ask us, can you start raising pork?
Right.
And we're like, you know, we want to be beef experts and, you know, cause it's, you know, learning cows is hard enough. Right. And so, but our family friends and, you know, neighbors here, the Gooksell family, they raise really good pork. And so what we did is we partnered with them and, you know, they raise Duroc hogs, and, you know, raise them naturally. So none of the growth promotants and things like that. Duroc is the breed. But then we're selling it under the Fisher Farms label, but still adhering to those standards of premium, natural, local, and sustainable. But yeah, you know, from a freshness standpoint, you know, dropped off a pork chop at a customer this afternoon and, you know, started talking and I was like, yeah, you know, this pig was alive yesterday, which, you know, some customers are a little like, oh, I don't know if I need to know that. But it just kind of shows that it falls into the same, you know, pattern of fresh to the customer. And so we're able to offer that same flexibility from a cutting perspective, but also just a freshness standpoint.
Yeah. And then you talk about local and other things, you know, the eggs, the turkey, there's so many other products, but it's from, again, like when I found out it was from the Amish and like the process, I was like, wait, time out. You got to do this in order to get some eggs. Yeah. So it's not just, so you've taken that kind of beyond the scope of, because now you've got logistics, you've got some of that framework that other farmers may not have, because that's right. Usually the hardest part, right? Distribution and the logistics and the frameworks that is usually the hardest part in the supply chain is that, but they can then kind of piggyback off of that. You can support the local community as well, but then also providing local fresh. Cause again, you're not going to put under your name if it doesn't meet that criteria.
Yeah, exactly.
And so. I would just add one thing to that is that probably one of the things I'm most proud of is the Amish community that we support. I mean, first of all, I really like these people. You know, I really am so impressed at how they live by their faith. I mean, they are really into it. And, you know, to tell you kind of the whole process, it's amazing to me. They cut ice off of their pond. They store the eggs in this insulated warehouse that's above the ground, right at the trucking height and so forth. But it's cooled by ice that they've pulled off of their pond. And they store that ice in their cellar. And they bring out more ice as they need it to keep this room cold. I mean, it's just amazing what they go through. I even told them one time, you know, if you want to build a warehouse a little bit off of your property, I got the neighbor to agree that I could build a warehouse there. I would pay for the electric to, you know, cool it and so forth. Well, they had a meeting amongst their elders and they said, no, we'll build the warehouse, but we're going to keep it cold with our ice.
Wow.
And they did.
We should also clarify, Indiana Egg Board is on board with all, it does meet all the safety specs and everything. Yep. They are inspected on that front.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, so we've talked the product and then we've talked briefly about, you know, the farm, but I do want to talk about the regenerative practices. And so I grew up on a farm. So like when I first met and we started talking topsoil and subsoil, I was like, oh my God. And people were like, what does that even matter? So maybe in kind of, I guess, in the layman's terms for more of the generic public, you know, what are you doing with all this crop rotation, you know, reducing methane? Because again, cows get such a bad rap. Oh, they produce methane and it's bad for the environment, but you guys have actually kind of neutralized a lot of that into the natural ecosystem.
Yeah. So a big part of that is through the crop rotation. And again, I mentioned this Dr. Christine Jones, who we had this regenerative ag conference that I went to about a month ago. And one of the things she said is one of the best ways to build soil is to plant the crop that is going to grow the best during that time of year. So there's C3 crops that grow well during the colder weather, basically under 85 degrees. And then all these crops that we're sitting out here in the middle of here in July are C4 crops. So they like it above 85 degrees. And so when you have that plant that's growing fast, that a lot of photosynthesis is going on, well, they pump a lot of sugars down into the ground via the exudates, via their roots. So they're feeding the biology in the soil. And that biology in the soil is really kind of the life and, you know, breath of the soil. And that's what we're really trying to build. And you know, to build that carbon, you basically, to put carbon down, you're building organic matter, which is practically the same thing. And so now when you look at it at a higher level, at a big picture, you know, photosynthesis, we're pulling in a lot of carbon dioxide. You know, 1 acre of corn pulls in 18 tons of carbon dioxide. The best way I explain that, so we work a lot with Indiana University, and so I talked to them about, you know, a football field is an acre, all right? 18 tons, 1 ton of carbon dioxide will fill a hot air balloon. So if you can picture 18 hot air balloons on a football field, and I've mapped it out, they don't fit, all right? So that's how much carbon we're pulling out of the air. And so, you know, a field like this, we're probably talking 8 tons per acre, something like that, based on the growth. I mean, in a short amount of time, you're talking like 60 days during the summer. But you got to have the right crop out there. If we had this in perennial fescue, during the summer months, it goes dormant, and you're just not getting that photosynthesis. So we plant ryegrass in September. Ryegrass grows well all winter long. Any day above 45 degrees, we're getting growth. We figure we're getting a good 6 tons of carbon dioxide pulled out of the air from September till June, till the ryegrass is kind of fizzling out. And so then you get more with these kind of plants in the summer. And all of that, you know, it's pulling carbon dioxide out of the air. And a lot of that's going down into the ground through these exudates, feeding the biology of the soil and adding to the organic matter. We had one professor come here in 2017. He did some analysis, places where we, you know, edge of fields and that kind of stuff, where we haven't done as much to rebuild the soil versus where we have built the soil. And he, his measurements were 3.9 inches of topsoil where we hadn't done any work on it. Where we did work for the last 7 years, we're up to 9.9 inches. Yeah, like over 6 inches of topsoil just added just by planting the right crops and also not doing tillage. It tears me up when I drive along the roads and I see fields that are tilled. Anytime it's tilled, basically you're releasing that carbon up in the air. Those microbes just love that oxygen. When you release them in the oxygen, now they go in a feeding frenzy, eating up all the carbon in the soil and releasing that up in the air. And so tillage is a bad thing for a lot of reasons. And if you're trying to store carbon, it's really bad.
Yeah. And so, you know, you guys got, you know, a big project that's coming up. You're growing like weeds. I mean, again, when I was introduced to you guys 6-7 years ago, it was what, 20 head?
Yeah,
a week, something like that, and it's up to where you're at now.
It's about 35, 40 a week. Yeah,
yeah, and it's just continuing to grow, right? I think people, it's part of this movement this year. What I've said is like home style, home just natural food it's coming back, mm-hmm. right? Everything comes full circle, right?
Right.
Fast food is becoming more unaffordable. People just can't eat like they should, and so they're looking for more natural ways to feed their families at home. So, you know, what's kind of on the horizon? You know, I've seen the blueprints, but I'll let you guys talk about, you know, what's coming up.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, the project you mentioned is we're working with the USDA, and a lot of that's really on the research things, you know, really doing that full life cycle analysis of what is our carbon footprint for raising them the way we're doing it. And, you know, we really want to make that a very low, if not a negative number. And, you know, we're not there yet necessarily, but we really got to do that full life cycle analysis to understand, you know, what is that number? And ultimately, we want to be able to then arm our customers with a quantitative number saying that, you know, by buying regeneratively raised, you know, beef, you took the equivalent of X number of cars off the road, or, you know, two airplanes out of the air, you know, whatever that number ultimately ends up being. So, you know, but that research is, you know, very complex. And so we're thankful to have some USDA financial support to help on the research side of things and in getting that done. But yeah, then from an expansion side of things, you know, we've kind of outgrown our existing facility. And so we're going to add on to that. And what we really want to do with that addition is add a little bit more automation and a little bit more efficiency to our processing. You know, that's one of the things that, you know, any small to medium size processor is going to have is, you know, you're competing with these, you know, the big four processing plants that butcher 6,000 beef a day. And there's some scale efficiencies there, right, versus what we're doing here. And so by kind of leveling up, if you will, from a equipment standpoint, those are cost savings that we can pass on to our customers, right, while still keeping that flexibility,
right,
that made to order, that cut to order, you know, mindset. We can kind of really bridge the gap of having both of those, you know, kind of best of both worlds, where we're super flexible, but also, you know, delivering at a cost to our customers that's highly competitive.
Oh yeah. Pricing is everything when it comes to, you know, the customer. And, you know, when you look at comparative apple to apples, it's just not fair, right? Because of the way you guys have built the farm the right way. When you do things the right way, things just come in full circle back. Right. And just, they work themselves out.
Right. It's not easy. It's not quick. But if you go the slow route and really understand what's going on and so forth, tweak this, tweak that, you know, and keep building, keep understanding, keep improving. And, you know, we're not at the end where we want to be. You know, we got a lot of improvements we can make yet.
Yeah. So what's some advice, you know, to farmers watching, to even the public that are watching? What are things that they can do to, you know, support their field, support their crops, you know, and then the public, you know, what can they do? Obviously buying the product, but, you know, just some tips that, you know, again, the farmer and the consumer can do just to also help, you know, with the environment.
And to me, one of the reasons, you know, we're sitting out in the middle of this field is to show, you know, the diversity of crops and how that helps, you know, and trying to get away from the monocultures of corn and soybeans, everybody planting corn and soybeans and pumping the fields full of the chemicals that the soybeans need to grow and so forth. And just trying to break that chain is kind of, you know, my biggest advice to farmers, you know, along with, you know, there's a big demand for people to know where their meat came from. So, you know, if you're a farmer out there and you're thinking about it, I'd say, you know, jump into it, try it, go to a farmer's market, start, you know, understanding what the customer wants, start meeting your customer. That's one thing that as a kid growing up, we raised a lot of hogs and so forth. I never met one customer, you know, had no idea who was eating this pork, you know, and so forth. And, you know, hauling it off to the big butcher plants and so forth when I was a kid, and the same way with our beef. It's just such a different experience when you get to meet the customer and you get to talk to them and they understand, you know, the care that you put into raising that animal and the genetics and the feedback they give you. So, you know, that's always my suggestion to farmers. You know, they call me up and say, you know, we want to do what you're doing. You know, what are the steps? I say, get out there and meet the customers. You know, to me, that's what should be driving things. What do they want? What do they want as far as wholesomeness? What do they want as taste? You know, and then, you know, try to hit those targets.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and it also takes that partnership from a balancing the animal perspective too, right? From a farmer perspective, you know, see these cows right behind us here. No. For every, you know, steer, there's 300 some pounds of ground beef we got to move for every 10 pounds of fillet steaks. And so if you don't have really good, you know, relationships, that partnership type approach with your customers, it's hard to find homes for all those pieces of meat. And I mean, don't get me wrong, it still keeps me up at night sometimes, is making sure that I've got homes for everything. So I was talking to a chef today about, you know, hey, can you help me take some of these baby back ribs off our plate, because we're real long on them right now. It's like, oh yeah, you know, I can make that work. And even, you know, when you were a customer, we were reminiscing earlier about how,
yeah,
you were loving the eye around and you're ordering more and more of it. And I was like, well, have you ever thought about trying a rolled rump? And you're like, I'll try it. And, you know, and it works. It ended up working well in your kitchen. And we kind of had that collaborative relationship where we were able to help piece together those different, literally, pieces of the cow. And selling all the pieces so that we're not putting stuff in the freezer, grinding it.
Yeah, because we didn't even touch on customer service, right? Like, we've talked the farm, we've talked the process, but then when it comes to customer service, again, it's not this massive team that's out there, you know, day to day grinding. I mean, Joseph, you've done most of that, and then a lot of it's obviously word of mouth and just, you know, the natural, or no pun intended, organic growth. But just seeing that responsiveness, seeing the education that you can bring, again, because even as a chef, I don't know all the cuts that there are and all the ways. And again, even when you introduce the rolled rump versus the eye round, I'm like, sure, if it gives me the same result that I'm looking for, I don't care where it comes from off that cow. And if it's going to help you, great. You're like, yep, it's a better, you know, same or better price. Awesome. Even better, because then I'm not worried about, you know, my cost of goods going up. So, you know, what, talk about your, I think it's important to talk about customer service, especially between like Diana, yourself, you know, what you're doing to strive to meet those customer needs. I know we talked about a little about that customization, but, you know, what are you doing to educate the customers when you talk to them?
Yeah, it's a lot about kind of establishing those relationships that you talked about. And you do that via talking to them a lot, you know, so it's a lot of the same customers I'm talking to at least once a week, if not a few times a week. And sometimes it's about meat. Sometimes it's about, you know, what their kids are doing, you know. But it's that relationship and that partnership that, first of all, makes my job more fun, right? Like, it's more than just sending emails and kind of the transactional side of business. It's that kind of collaborative approach. But ultimately, we also understand, because, you know, we're a small business, that you when things don't go right, you really hope your partners work to make it right. And so when we're out, you know, talking to customers and they're like, we just got absolutely hammered on a Friday night. Is there any way we can get more steaks for, you know, Saturday service, you know? And we're going to do whatever we can to try to help them get through that, because we know they're in a spot where they could use our help. Right. And, so that customer service side of things is always something we're going to do whatever we can to make it work. But to your question on the education side of things, we love to have them to the farm, and really, you know, when they can sit out in a field like this, and we don't always necessarily hit, but we always walk them.
That looks like a pretty tasty one, right?
Don't let them hear you. but yeah, that's where it becomes, I think, a little bit more of a less of a story and more of something they can visualize and kind of relate back to. So anytime we can get folks to the farm, we're like, open door. Whenever it works for your schedule, because usually the chefs and the, you know, the restaurant owners have a harder schedule to manage than us. We're here pretty much every day.
Yep.
We love to have them to the farm, because then they can see it for themselves. They can, you know, we started our butcher facility and we talk to the butchers. And that's a lot of times really fun for our butchers, because they get to kind of see the end customer. And they talk pork chops for 10, 15 minutes about like, hey, can you cut this off? Like, can you make this longer? Like, no problem. We can do that. But then we bring them to the farm where they can see the cows, the sustainability practices, all those things, and just kind of, it brings it full circle where they can then go back to their teams, their customers, and talk about it. So, and for the customers that they can't make it here, I'll do server training, you know, and that kind of stuff, so that whenever customers are, you know, looking at something on a menu, they can say, you know, who's Fisher Farms? And they can say, oh, I've actually met Joseph Fisher, and this is how they do things. So that's, it's all part of telling that story to ultimately whoever's eating the product.
Yeah, it's powerful to, you know, when you come out and you see it and wait, this is how they're raised and everything else. As a chef, a true, you know, someone who loves food, it's incredible to get out and to see, you know, just nature and what it's supposed to be. You know, it's like bringing it back to the good old days, you know, as you say, and not just these massive feedlots. It's just great. And then again, it's just natural word of mouth. I couldn't wait to get back to talk to people about it. You can't believe this visit I had at the farm. You can't believe what I saw. You can't believe what we talked about. And I tried to regurgitate as much information as I picked up with like the topsoil and the subsoil. I'm like, I don't know all the facts per se. It's all on the website, but you know, this is what I learned, and then tried to educate people, because it just gets you excited as a chef. You're like, and then like you said, this pork chop literally is 2 days. 2 days fresh. You are not going to get a fresher pork chop than what you are eating right this second.
Right.
And it's just good quality food.
Butchered Monday morning, cooled down Monday night, cut to order on Tuesday.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah. And we should say, because we've talked some on the pork about how fresh it is, on the beef side of things, we're dry aging for 2 weeks.
Right.
And so that's kind of the difference between beef and pork, is you actually want to dry age that beef. And during that time period, we're losing, 15% weight on the fish or farm side of things,
right,
where you're losing kind of that water, that humidity out of the meat. But what you get is a more tender,
right,
product and a more flavorful product.
Right.
You get that condensing that flavor. And then that's when we're cutting fresh to order. So it's still a fresh cut steak. It's got the 14 days of age on it. And then it's, going out the door.
And we're losing that moisture instead of when the customer gets the package and cuts it open and all that goes down the drain. We've already lost that moisture, before. So again, our prices might be a little bit higher, but if you factor in the 15% loss in that,
it's pretty well. And if you haven't eaten a 14-day dry hung just hamburger, like that's the thing that blew my mind. I'm like, this is a 14 dry aged hamburger, at the end of the day. And people are like, what? And I'm like, yeah, the carcass hangs there for 2 weeks. And again, I'm trying to do the education on, dry aging and working with the cabinets, and appreciative of you guys with the cuts of beef that we've done. I can't wait to do the ribeye that's coming up next at 42 days and keep that progressing, because it's even another level of flavor that intensifies that. And you guys can watch that stuff on YouTube. Plenty of videos that I'm working on that. So anything I missed in this whole ecosystem in this conversation?
Yeah, I think one thing we haven't talked about from like a sustainability side of things is probably the water side of things. It's talked about a lot, kind of as we have more of these like extreme weather events. And something we've done on our farm is we really want to conserve water, but then also clean water as well. And so the cattle, the water trough right over here, is gravity fed from a pond on our farm. So we're, completely off the city water grid from a cattle water perspective. And cows do drink a lot of water, especially days when it's 90 degrees outside, they're drinking water to cool themselves. But then, we're not tilling on our fields, so we have much better water retention when it rains. We really want to absorb that rain like a sponge and not be kind of that concrete, hard, that crusty field where the water just runs right off down into the creek. You're losing topsoil when you do that. But then when we do have runoff, we capture it via a series of ponds that are, scattered throughout the farm. And then ultimately, those ponds feed into a wetland, which we built, what was that, probably 10, 15 years ago, something like that, about 10 years ago. And that wetland is, a serpentine wetland that has cattails and all kinds of wetland grasses and duckweed. And what that's doing is, letting the water settle at each one of those ponds, getting filtered, in that final step by the wetland. So when that water leaves our home property here, it's very clean. Like you do the mason jar test and you can see how it's cloudy when it starts and it's clean when it leaves. And really think that's kind of becoming a more important step in making sure that the water that leaves our farm, we want it to be clean, right?
Right.
And so that's something that we're passionate about too, and always trying to figure out kind of what are the new things we can do on the water conservation and filtration side of things.
Super cool. Well, where do people go? They want to learn more about Fisher Farms. Obviously, come to the farm. I mean, you want to come to the farm.
That's right.
Shoot me an email. Look them up. But where else do they go if they want to learn more about what you guys are doing?
Yeah, so you can go to our social media handles, our Fisher Farms. So FISCHER Farms IN. That's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Our website is FisherFarmsIN.com. And that's where you can find all kinds of information about what we're doing on the farm, where you can buy our products, all that good stuff.
Wow. This has been great. Thank you both. And the hospitality, while I've been down here has been amazing. Takes me back home. Like literally, like I was a child again, just reminiscing being in fields and just that good comfort feeling being around. And it doesn't feel awkward. It's just, like you said, it's that family feeling. So it's not a gimmick. It's not a story. Like that is who they are. So thank you so much for what, you've done for me and what you're doing. And there's so much more to come. So, be sure to check out the website, check out their social handles. There's crazy stuff. Like there was post just the other day of how the ice packs are actually can be used as compost, right? You can cut them
fertilizer for
your plants. I mean, come on. Like, how much more full circle can you ask? I didn't even know those things. So they're doing things all the time, packaging everything to try and make things as sustainable as possible. So again, thank you both. And I know we trekked out into the field just to do this, but I think it's worth every minute of it. The kettle behind us, I don't know if it'll be in the shot, but it's just great, especially now the sun's going down. It's great. So again, thank you. And to everyone watching, we'll catch you next time on the Sunny Side.
HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.